The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Judith Collins.
Speaker, to the Prime Minister, does she support a policy which would allow New Zealanders to access up to $20,000 from their KiwiSaver to start a new business?
I'm going to ask the member to ask the question as per the order paper.
All right. Does she support a policy which would allow New Zealanders to access up to $20,000 from their KiwiSaver to start a new business?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, this government supports increasing support for our small businesses, and that is why we have made consultancy services available to small businesses to the tune of $5,000. It's why we have increased the small asset depreciation threshold from $500 to $5,000. It's why we've introduced the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme, which has paid out nearly $1.5 billion. It's why we increased the provisional tax threshold, encouraged prompt invoice payment, supported business through the wage subsidy scheme, and of course have introduced e-commerce initiatives. I do have concerns, however, around the proposal that the member has mentioned, which will undermine New Zealanders' retirement savings. And I also have to say I have concerns that the policy the member has put forward is as yet uncosted.
Before I call a member, I wish to apologise to her. I unfortunately had a sheet with a slightly different question on it.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, is there anything wrong with a builder who has lost his job because of COVID-19 being able to use up to $20,000 of his own KiwiSaver to put towards a van and some new tools so he can start his own building business?
Mr. Speaker, my advice would be to anyone who finds themselves currently unemployed and wishes to start their own business is don't for a moment think that you need to gamble with your retirement savings when instead through the Ministry of Social Development.
Order.
And Minister,
including Mr. Tabata.
When, Mr. Speaker, through MSD, someone can access the Flexi Wage Subsidy to start their own business and to support themselves as a self-employed person. They can also access, through MSD, a business startup fund that can give them up to $10,000 to start up their own business. Mr. Speaker, when, unfortunately, roughly two-thirds of small businesses that start up in a two-year period will be unsuccessful, I do not want to see those people currently unemployed who may wish to start their own business risk their KiwiSaver when they don't have to.
Is she saying she would rather have someone on the job seeker benefit than let them use their own money to start their own business?
Mr. Speaker, no, I'm saying that KiwiSaver is for people's retirement. We should not be depleting that important resource for them. And Mr. Speaker, as KiwiSaver, some KiwiSaver providers themselves have pointed out that the value actually of what the member is proposing through from someone at the age of, say, 40 through to their retirement actually represents more than a $60,000 loss. What I am saying is there are already forms of government support that help people with startups, the cost of starting up, the cost of paying themselves and surviving while they start up, and the cost of advisory services.
Order.
The member obviously hasn't looked at some of those packages that already exist.
Why is it okay for someone to access their KiwiSaver to buy a new house but not to start a new business?
Okay, there are three reasons at the moment someone can access KiwiSaver outside of their retirement. Firstly, sadly, if they have a terminal illness, if they have hardship needs that are identified as being genuine hardship, and if they are purchasing a house. I think on both sides of the house we agree that a house is an asset that carries far less risk than a start-up. Which, Mr. Speaker, based on normal circumstances, two-thirds of our business startups in New Zealand in a two-year period will not succeed. In this current environment, it's likely to be even more difficult. Mr. Speaker, again, I conclude by saying there are alternatives already there which don't have to draw on someone's retirement savings. I know that Member's Party has a tradition of tinkering with KiwiSaver. We do not agree with that.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Does the Prime Minister agree with the proposition that KiwiSaver is, quote, money put aside for a rainy day, or does she believe that it is money for security and retirement?
Mr Speaker, KiwiSaver is not for the purposes of being able to draw down at any time. We must support New Zealanders to have a good standard of living in their retirement. That means supporting them to hang on to their KiwiSaver for their retirement. And we see it as our role to provide other ways through other mechanisms like the Flexi Wage, like business start-up support, and that already exists.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
But I ask the Prime Minister, in the construction of the government's policy on KiwiSaver, has she received any reports from any Conservative Party anywhere in the world arguing against the wisdom of savings?
Mr Speaker, there is certainly a consistency around the need for consumers to save for their retirement. The last thing we want to see is a repeat of what we saw under the last National Government, which was constant changes and uncertainty to KiwiSaver settings.
Does the Prime Minister consider that losing one's job or being made redundant is hardship?
Mr Speaker, yes, which is why we have the income support payment, which is why we have provided $5,000 worth of advisory services through the Business Partnership Network, which is why MSD has the Flexi Wage Scheme, which is why we have the $10,000 in support of people who wish to create a startup. Yes, unemployment is hardship, but we do not want to create double hardship by having someone potentially lose their KiwiSaver.
Why does the Prime Minister have so little faith in entrepreneurial and hard-working New Zealanders who have experience in many cases of running businesses that they can't access?
The member is making a series of assertions. She will ask a question.
Right. Does the Prime Minister have any confidence in entrepreneurial New Zealanders who have experience in running businesses, who can verify that they understand how to run one?
Order.
Mr Speaker, absolutely, which is why we have a scheme already in place to back those businesses through the Ministry of Social Development. And I'd like to think that that is an endorsement of the fact that that entrepreneurialism exists in New Zealand and is supported by us. And other examples, of course, include the fact that we have established a venture capital fund to support those startups as well.
Question number two, Jenny Marcroft.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Regional Economic Development and asks, how is the Provincial Growth Fund helping tackle long-term issues in our regional communities?
The Honourable Shane Jones.
Mr Speaker, over the last 3 years, the PGF Fund has addressed long-term deficits in both infrastructure and social investment to the tune of $1.1 billion to infrastructure projects up and down the country, $100 million to skills. On top of that, we've seen 11,000 people enrol in PGF-funded schools and training initiatives, and we have addressed the degradation of rail, the state of the roads in Tairāwhiti, and boosted digital connectivity up and down our regional communities.
What recent announcements have been made relating to addressing long-term social issues in our regions?
Mr Speaker, I'm sure all members of the House have had the awful experience of encountering the social negative consequences, Mr Speaker, of the P drug. Police Minister Stuart Nash and I announced an investment of up to $20 million in regional programs to help reduce the damage that P causes to whānau and businesses. This particular initiative was driven by identities associated with business associations, employers who are at their wits' end in our small provincial areas. We are working with the police and the health department to identify additional providers who have a proven track record, and we are keen to scale up their programs to enable more Kiwis to move on from this demon drug and take jobs and enterprises.
Sure. Supplementary. Was this investment part of the recent reply?
Speaker. Yes, it was. Our Cabinet agreed to allocate up to $20 million to meth prevention in the regions. This is reflective of the fact that we do want Kiwis taking jobs in enterprises near their place of residence. We cannot rely, as historically we have, on unfettered access to pools of migrant labour. Small communities are under considerable stress in the post-COVID lockdown, and there is the threat of economic uncertainty. For those reasons, we believe this is an overdue investment in employee health and employer resilience.
Which regions will benefit from this funding allocation?
For meth prevention, we've identified 9 community-based providers: Otago, Tairāwhiti, Hawke's Bay, Bay of Plenty, and strangely enough, Northland. A number of the programs will target gangs, but as there may be a bit of raucousness in the House, sadly, the projects will need to give support to children, whānau, grandparents dealing with the reality of raising mokopuna or grandchildren because of the blighted lives of their parents as a consequence of excessive addiction to meth.
Question number 3, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question's to the Minister of the Finance. What are the latest projections he has received on the number of job losses this calendar year and the increase in government debt over the same period?
Speaker. The Honourable Grant Robertson.
The Treasury forecasts the net change in employment. In its latest budget forecast, they have forecast employment of 2.642 million people in the first quarter of the year and employment of 2.523 million in the fourth quarter, a difference of 119,000 in net employment due to the impact of the 1-in-100-year economic shock created by the global COVID-19 pandemic. It is worth comparing this to the Treasury's earlier scenarios released in April, which did not incorporate the extra investment announced by the government at Budget 2020. Scenario one of these showed employment dropping by 177,000 over the year and by as much as 260,000 during the year, indicating the difference made by the investments announced in the budget. In answer to the second part of the member's question, net core crown debt was 21% of GDP at the start of the year, and I'm advised by the Treasury they expect this to be around 39% of GDP at the end of the year. Obviously, the pre-election fiscal update will finalise these forecasts.
Does he agree that it's the tens of thousands of owners, large and small, deciding that will create most of the sustainable new jobs that will need to re-employ those New Zealanders that have lost their jobs?
Mr. Speaker, we in New Zealand are blessed with a range of entrepreneurial businesses who do and create, indeed create, many jobs. What they're appreciating from this government is that they have a partner in the government who will back them.
Does he agree that allowing New Zealanders who have lost their job to use up to $20,000 from their own KiwiSaver fund to start a new business will help some of them get back on their feet?
Mr. Speaker, as we've discussed with the Prime Minister just recently, no. And I would also point to a number of comments that have come in response to this proposal, including describing it as scary and dangerous.
Yeah, proper financial advisor.
Does he accept that we have a jobs emergency now and we need to try different things?
Speaker, we have a crisis that is a 1-in-100-year shock to the New Zealand economy. That is why, on this side of the House, we have committed such significant resources to supporting growth in jobs right across the economy.
Does he agree with the Prime Minister just now that starting a business is gambling?
Speaker, that's not what the Prime Minister said. That's not what the Prime Minister said at all. What the Prime Minister said was that we do not endorse the view that somehow or other KiwiSaver is some kind of rainy day fund. It's not. It's a fund for people to have security in retirement. But what I've seen from the member opposite is a constant undermining of that security. Not only do we have today's policy, but we also have his view that there will be no contributions to the New Zealand Super Fund. New Zealand Super Fund suffered enough from that in the last 9 years before this government came in.
Does he trust New Zealanders to assess for themselves their appetite for risk, acknowledging that starting a business is riskier than leaving funds in a conservative KiwiSaver fund.
Mr. Speaker, it is quite clear that the member on the other side of the House doesn't want New Zealanders to have security in their retirement. He's undermining the New Zealand Super Fund. Now he wants to undermine KiwiSaver. It's a fund for security and retirement.
Can I ask the Minister of Finance as to whether or not the questioner has shared with him his extensive business experience?
Order, order. It doesn't quite relate to the question. Question number four, Dr. Deborah Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy in the context of the global COVID-19 pandemic?
In a report released on Monday, Kiwi Bank economists released a 90-day performance review report looking at how the New Zealand economy has performed since lockdown restrictions lifted. Kiwi Bank said, quote, "The high-frequency data we're monitoring has been encouraging. Transactional spending data shows households are still swiping their cards, and manufacturing data shows the sector is back in expansion. Our economic recovery is well and truly underway. Compared to the rest of the world, we look good." Similarly, ASB economists said in their Economic Weekly report that the quick recovery from extreme depths of pessimism is a ray of light amid the doom and gloom and clear challenges that the New Zealand economy faces in rebuilding and reshaping itself. Mr. Speaker, we have always been clear that the path ahead will be difficult for many New Zealanders, but it is pleasing to see that the economy is performing better than expected since lockdown, giving us a strong platform from which to navigate the challenges ahead.
What reports has he seen on challenges to New Zealand's economic recovery?
Mr. Speaker, ASB said in its report, quote, "There are still many challenges ahead, given New Zealand's borders are likely to be heavily restricted for some time, and that the rest of the world is having a tougher time than New Zealand in dealing with the pandemic." Mr. Speaker, the problems other countries are having in keeping COVID-19 under control and the associated economic costs of reinstating restrictions there underscore the importance of the government's decision to go hard and early against the virus. They also inevitably will have an impact on the New Zealand economy as an open trading nation.
What actions has the government taken to ensure it is able to respond if any of these risks intensify?
Mr. Speaker, last week I announced that the remaining $14 billion of the COVID-19 Response and Recovery Fund is being set aside to make sure New Zealand is in a strong position to fight whatever COVID-19 throws at the economy. This is a move that Westpac economists described this week as a sensible move. It is the responsible thing to do at a time when global infections are increasing dramatically and many countries reinstitute restrictions. Mr. Speaker, Kiwi firms and workers can have confidence that we'll continue to act swiftly and decisively in our ongoing fight against this virus in these uncertain times.
The Honourable Paul Gosman.
Why does he think that the only solution can be more government spending and more debt rather than allowing Kiwis who have lost their jobs to access their KiwiSaver funds to start their own business and create their own jobs and opportunities?
No, that didn't start with the question. Question number five, the Honourable Gerry Browning.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Housing and asks, does she stand by her statements on the 19th of July? Quote, people returning
right, now,
to New Zealand.
Sorry, can we just check? I think it's the Minister of Housing.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
That's what I said.
Okay. I'm sorry, I misheard the member.
Oh, it's sorry. It's
not having a good day.
Might be the tide or the moon. Can I start again?
Well, I'm pretty tempted to say no.
Yeah, but you wouldn't do that.
I'm being very generous to the member.
Okay.
The member
Thank
will
you.
Start again.
Thank you. I do appreciate that, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Housing, does she stand by her statement on the 19th of July, quote, people returning to New Zealand should assist with the considerable expense of accommodating them in managed isolation facilities, end quote. If so, how much of the $479 million budgeted for managed isolation does the government expect to recoup from people returning to this country?
The Honourable Dr. Megan Boyds.
Mr. Speaker, yes. And I've been clear from the outset that the implementation of a cost recovery system is complex, We have carefully considered how to design a system that is fair and not a barrier for returning to New Zealanders. Indicative modelling shows that the scheme would generate between $2.2 and $8.8 million a year at a cost of recouping that of $600,000. The government's proposal has struck an appropriate balance to ensure taxpayers aren't forking out for people who want to come or go for holidays or business, while returning New Zealanders who want to come home to live are able to do so without an unreasonable limitation. There have been calls to apply a charge to all returning New Zealanders. The most realistic scenario for such a blanket approach with the legally required fee waivers and exemption would see $126 million generated at a cost of $33 million to recoup it. So we need to put the counterfactual in context. The managed isolation and quarantine system is going to cost taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars regardless.
Mr Speaker, is the Minister telling the House that the restriction or the charging regime brought in today may bring in something less than $10 million, but the taxpayer is still going to be left with $469 million worth of costs for managed isolation?
Mr Speaker, that is what I said in the answer to the primary question, but what I also said in the answer to the primary question, that the counterfactual of doing universal charging with all the required legal waivers and exemptions for those charges would only bring in net $93 million. So regardless of the regime, the taxpayer is going to be left with a bill of several hundred million dollars to provide this strong line of defence at our borders.
Mr Speaker, does the Minister accept that the counterfactual, as she put it to the House today, is simply a contrivance to try and cover up an appallingly joke-based system for charging people coming into New Zealand?
Mr Speaker, this government takes very seriously the presence of managed isolation and quarantine facilities and would never describe them as a joke. We think they are an important line of defence, and we also think that it is important that we work through the policy around these facilities in a measured and methodical way. What we have worked through is what the legal risks and challengeability in the courts would be around different kinds of charging regimes that could be stood up. What we as a government accept is that we need to put the appropriate appropriations in place. Long-term hotel contracts need to be entered into, and we are not putting the system at risk with a legally challengeable regime.
Mr Speaker, what is legally challenging about saying to New Zealanders who are coming back to this country, having been away for quite some time, that the costs of their managed isolation, the cost of their rejoining the team of 5 million, is a charge that they need to meet?
Mr Speaker, this is a complex legal area, and I know an easy political soundbite, but the advice that we have worked through in a lot of detail with Crown Law is about whether any charge to enter a public health managed isolation facility, a requirement of entry to your own country that is placed on all New Zealanders, constitutes a barrier of entry to your country. There are some mitigations that can be put in place to reduce that. Some of that is around making sure you have financial hardship schemes in place. By the time you put all of those mitigations in place that mean this simply will not be overturned by the courts, you're only looking at a net contribution for returnees of around $93 million.
Why has the government not come to Parliament to introduce a law that would make legal the charges that she apparently says cannot be implied so that the taxpayer of New Zealand can be relieved of some of this extraordinary burden for people who want to come back and join the team of 5 million?
Because, Mr Speaker, this government has come to this Parliament with a law that is not going to be legally overturned by the courts, that what it does is puts in place a regime that does not stample on the Bill of Rights and the rights of New Zealanders to return to their country. The member may like to look at the legislation that has been tabled this afternoon.
Mr Speaker, where does the Minister think a law passed by the Parliament of New Zealand would be overturned by the courts?
Mr. Speaker, a thing called the Bill of Rights.
So does her policy mean that a business person travelling offshore to gain new markets for New Zealand will pay for their managed quarantine when they come back, but someone who had chosen to make a life offshore, perhaps for many years, will come back into this country to join the team of 5 million, paying nothing?
Mr. Speaker, the regime that we have outlined today would see anyone that was leaving for a holiday or for business pay for their isolation and factor that into the cost of their trip overseas. What we are saying is if a New Zealander is seeking to return to their home, to make their life here, to work here, to pay tax here, to send their children to school here, they will not be required to pay. But Mr. Speaker, if I choose to go on holiday, I am quite happy to factor in the cost of my own managed isolation and not expect the taxpayer to pick up the tab.
So does that mean that someone who is travelling offshore to expand markets, to expand the New Zealand economy, who's paid tax in this country, perhaps for years, will pay for their managed isolation after their business trip, but someone just coming into the country, having been away for years, not paid tax in this country, gets in free?
Mr. Speaker, anyone who is returning to live home permanently will not pay those. If someone is returning for a period of less than 90 days, then yes, they will be required to pay. But Mr. Speaker, if someone is leaving the country in order to expand their markets and there is a commercial element to it, I think that on the fair and balanced approach that New Zealand taxpayers should expect some of the cost of that to be borne.
So, one more time, if I may, Mr. Speaker, does that mean that someone who is trying to expand their markets out of New Zealand, presumably to retain and keep jobs in New Zealand, pays for their quarantine, but someone who just comes in, having lived away for perhaps years, paid tax in other jurisdictions,
question.
Comes in free?
Mr. Speaker, I've already answered this question twice, but if that member requires something to be repeated three times in order to understand it, then there's the answer, Mr. Speaker. A New Zealander who is seeking refuge in their own country, who wants to return to make their life here, they will not be paying. But yes, again, for the third time, if someone is going overseas on business, just as someone is going overseas on a holiday, we are asking them to make a contribution.
Yes.
Why is it unfair to charge New Zealanders who are returning? No question about their ability to come back into the country, but why is it unfair to charge them for quarantine when those people who stay here but might leave for a business purpose have to pay for their quarantine?
Mr. Speaker, I think what the member needs to do is look at what is actually a very fair and balanced system. What we have here is a system of those who are choosing to be holiday makers or go away on business are going to be asked to contribute to the cost of their quarantine. Those who are seeking to come back and make their life in this country and are going to contribute to this country are not being asked to pay.
The Prime Minister.
Supplementary, can the Minister confirm that in drawing together this policy, the government has created a distinction between those who are currently in their legal place of residence, New Zealand, and who have a choice around travel contributing to their quarantine versus those who are offshore, may not have long-term stability of residence, may not have long-term stability around income, who are caught in a 1-in-100-year event through no fault of their own, having the ability to return home to their place of residence?
Mr. Speaker, yes, that is certainly that was a critical part of our decision making. So was the very practical evidence that if we were, even if you were to look at standing up the kind of universal regime that the opposition is talking about, you'd only be talking about a net contribution of $93 million. Mr. Speaker, we take the managed isolation facilities incredibly seriously, and having stability of the stability funding sorted out and the ability for long-term contracting is absolutely critical to having safe and managed isolation facilities.
Why has the government not been able to accept that people can come into New Zealand if they have a right to, but still should pay for the quarantine that falls as a burden currently and for the foreseeable future on the general taxpayer?
Mr. Speaker, as I have outlined several times to that member, regardless of the regime that has stood up, the taxpayers of New Zealand are going to be left with a bill of several hundred million dollars to provide this public health strong line of defence against COVID coming back into our communities. Mr. Speaker, I think New Zealanders will be somewhat alarmed to see the attitude that the opposition has around their commitment to providing this strong line of defence. We see it as a responsibility of our government, and exactly why we are in the unique position we are in the world. The taste of what would come from the opposition is on clear display.
Question number 6, the Honourable Louise Ashton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and asks, does she stand by all her statements and actions? Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Potter Williams.
On behalf of the Minister, yes. Does she stand by her statement that, quote, New Zealanders need to be supported, we are able into work, and that employment needs to be a focus for us?
On behalf of the Minister, yes.
What does she say to the owner of Steam Cleans in Blenheim, who has since February been trying to fill three vacancies for cleaners, and that last week MSD have said to them, despite 874 job seekers, they don't have anyone who can fill these jobs?
On behalf of the Minister, while I can't confirm or verify what that member claims, what I can confirm is that we are continuing to perform better than the economists predicted. For example, the exits from benefits into work for June was around 7,500 compared to 5,200 the same time last year. We're helping people get into jobs. The recent infrastructure announcement helped kickstart the post-COVID rebuild, creating more than 20,000 jobs and unlocking more than $5 billion worth of projects up and down New Zealand.
Does she agree that with 210,000 New Zealanders currently receiving unemployment benefits, that a job is better than no job, and if not, why not?
On behalf of the Minister, what I can confirm is that that this government does have a plan. We are lucky enough to have a Minister of Employment who's developed a strategy that outlines
what we plan on doing. The Minister of Finance will stand, withdraw and apologise. The Honourable Gerry Browning. Right.
Thank you. As I was saying, we have a Minister for Employment that has developed a strategy that outlines what we plan on doing over the next 4 years. For example, building a strong workforce that meets business needs and engages lifelong learning,
order,
supports provincial New Zealand and industries to be successful. We are a government that is acting now to prepare for the future.
Does she stand by her statement that, and I quote, employers are looking for a level of skill that our Ministry of Social Development clients aren't always equipped with? That is why this government is focused on upskilling and training so that people can get into meaningful and sustainable employment, unquote. And if so, is she now saying that cleaners, who during the COVID lockdown were deemed essential workers, are not engaged in meaningful employment?
On behalf of the Minister, to answer the first part of that question, yes.
Question number 7, Maya Lubick.
My question is to the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety and asks, what recent announcements has the government made regarding protecting migrant workers from exploitation?
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, earlier this week, along with the Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters and Immigration Minister Chris Farfoy, I announced changes that will better protect temporary migrant workers by preventing exploitation and improving enforcement of the law. The package we announced will help migrant workers to better understand their rights and responsibilities when working in New Zealand and will also provide a clear avenue for help should they find themselves in an exploitative situation. The government's investing $50 million over 4 years to support the implementation of these changes. As set out in the coalition agreement, protecting migrant workers from exploitation is a priority for the government, and I'd like to acknowledge the New Zealand First Party for their support and work on this important issue.
Supplementary, how will the changes be implemented?
Mr. Speaker, to make it easier for migrant workers to report and leave exploitative employment, we'll be setting up a new dedicated free phone number, online reporting and triaging functions. Exploited migrants whose visas are tied to exploitative employers will be able to be granted another temporary visa, which enables them to find alternative employment. We're also investing in additional labour inspectors and immigration investigators to ensure that robust action is taken against exploitative employers, and to develop information and education so that migrant workers better understand their rights and how to report exploitation.
Supplementary. Why is this important in light of COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, due to the effects of COVID-19, many migrants who are on temporary visas and unable to return home may currently find that they are in a more vulnerable position than before the pandemic arrived in New Zealand. Exploitation is an issue which affects all of us. It causes financial and mental harm to workers, and it also harms legitimate businesses who are undercut by these practices and damages New Zealand's reputation as a fair place to work, live and do business.
Question number 8, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Finance, does he agree with the Prime Minister's statement yesterday regarding the announcement of the 150 shovel-ready projects? Quote, where there are projects that we have not yet announced publicly, that is because we are still, in some cases, undertaking due diligence, end quote. If so, how many projects have completed due diligence but are unannounced?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, yes, I always agree with the Prime Minister. On the 1st of July, we announced that there were more than 150 projects to be funded under the IRG. Of these, we have announced 79 projects, representing more than $1 billion of Crown investment and more than $2 billion of total project value. These announcements have happened because officials have provided assurances of the project's overall viability, including but not limited to due diligence. We've made it very clear that all approvals are in principle, subject to further due diligence and contract negotiations.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. This is a question on notice, and the second part of the primary question about how many projects have completed due diligence but are unannounced, I don't believe was actually addressed by the Minister.
Well, I think it was addressed. It wasn't answered, but it was addressed.
How many projects of the 150-plus shovel-ready projects the Minister's just mentioned have completed due diligence but have not yet been announced?
Mr. Speaker, the reason that projects have not yet been announced are varied. Some of those are to do with due diligence, some of those are to do with contract negotiations, and some of those are to do with other verification of the projects, including the financing by partners.
How many projects have yet to be announced that have completed due diligence?
Mr. Speaker, there are a variety of reasons it's not possible to separate out.
For the third time, how many?
Said it is not possible to divide out the different reasons for why projects have not been announced.
Michael Wood.
Has he seen a statement from the Employers and Manufacturers Association about the announced shovel-ready projects, which says, quote, some of these projects have been on the books in Auckland and elsewhere for a number of years, so finally getting them consented and fast-tracked is a welcome development. This is a government using its powers in a way that clears regulatory hurdles and gets stuff done, just what we need at the moment. And does he intend to continue working with organisations like the EMA as more projects are confirmed and announced?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I welcome those comments, and indeed I welcome the reaction to the IRG projects right around New Zealand, which has been one of welcoming the fact that in many cases these are projects that communities have wanted for years and they now have a government that's backing them.
Supplementary. Is it correct that tomorrow the government will announce funding for the rebuild of the Nainai Pool in Lower Hutt? And if so, when was due diligence completed on that project?
Mr. Speaker, the member will just have to wait.
I'm not allowed to make a comment on that, am I? Question number nine, Dr. Shane Reddy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Associate Minister of Health, what are the policies around the flu vaccine this year and how has supply been managed?
Mr.
The Honourable Julianne Ginta.
We started this year's influenza campaign like our COVID-19 response. We wanted to go hard and early, focusing on getting vaccines out earlier than normal, with a particular focus on those eligible to receive a funded vaccine because they're more at risk of hospitalisation, and healthcare workers. This has been a record year for flu vaccines, with more than 1.75 million vaccines already distributed to general practices, pharmacists and other providers. That's 400,000 more than ever before in a single year, and we still have around 400,000 doses in stock. So to put that in context, in New Zealand, we have 800,000 more vaccines in the country than in any previous record year. That's a 60% increase. Supply has been managed in the same way as in previous years. Pharmac contracts a supplier to provide funded vaccinations for the New Zealand public. Orders for flu vaccines were placed in October last year, well before there was a global pandemic. If a provider is unable to obtain flu vaccine stock, they should contact their DHB immunisation coordinator.
Supplementary. Is it correct that after issues with supply, Pharmac ordered unused flu vaccine from the Northern Hemisphere, a vaccine which only matches half of the four recommended flu strains in New Zealand this year?
Yes.
Supplementary. How many of the Northern Hemisphere flu vaccines have been given to date, and are New Zealanders getting the rejects from the Northern Hemisphere?
Mr. Speaker, these aren't rejects. They've been approved by MedSafe. They protect people against the flu. And I didn't mention earlier, but we have record low cases of flu in addition to our record numbers of people who've been vaccinated. If he wants to put down a specific question to me about in writing about numbers of flu vaccine, as he often does, we'll be happy to answer it.
Supplementary. When New Zealanders are given the Northern Hemisphere vaccine, are they told that half of the vaccine does not match the recommended best practice flu strains for this year?
Mr. Speaker, the Northern Hemisphere flu vaccine protects against some strains of flu, and we have a record number of flu vaccines in the country, both for the Southern Hemisphere and the Northern Hemisphere. What I would say is that there was record demand because of the COVID-19 global pandemic, and that's great because we've achieved record numbers of vaccination. And because of that, and the fact that it takes 6 months to order the vaccines, Pharmac was able to purchase 400,000 additional vaccines to help ensure that everybody was able to receive a flu vaccine who wanted one.
Speaker. Question number 10, Willow Jean Prime.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Food Safety. What steps has the government taken to increase awareness of the dangers of drinking during pregnancy?
Mr. Speaker. The Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Mr. Speaker, this government wants to make New Zealand be the best place in the world to be a child, and that starts in the womb. That's why we'll be moving to mandatory pregnancy warning labels on alcohol products. This was agreed on the 17th of July at a meeting of the Australia and New Zealand Ministerial Forum on Food Regulation. We share a food standard system with Australia, so any decisions like this are made jointly. Mr. Speaker, this label will provide a standard message that is clear and consistent on the importance of not drinking while pregnant. The label will help protect the public health of New Zealanders, and it will bring us in line with other countries that require mandatory pregnancy warning labels, such as the USA and France. Mr. Speaker, it also complements educational and behavioural campaigns that are delivered by the Health Promotion Agency that seek to inform and reduce the risk of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders.
Supplementary. How does this label balance effectiveness with industry concerns?
Mr. Speaker, the alcohol industry has been voluntarily including warnings on some products since 2011, but there has been no consistency in type, colour, size and design, which all play a part in reducing effectiveness. Food Standards Australia and New Zealand undertook a robust process to develop an effective label that included a full consultation process and cost-benefit analysis. We now have a standard message that is clear and consistent, Mr. Speaker. Here it is, on the importance of not drinking while pregnant. I have just signed the food notice to bring this into New Zealand law from this week, from the 31st of July, with a three-year transitional period. Mandatory labels will be required by the 31st of July 2023.
Supplementary. Why do we need pregnancy warning labels on alcohol products?
Mr. Speaker, the formative months in pregnancy are the foundations for a long, healthy and happy life. Science has not yet been able to determine a safe level of alcohol consumption during pregnancy. The best advice we have is to refrain. Consumption of alcohol during pregnancy can cause fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, which results in a range of problems such as intellectual and behavioural deficits, as well as irreversible damage to the brain and body. It is a lifelong issue which significantly impacts on individuals and families and the wider community. Mr. Speaker, the Ministry of Health estimates that 1,800 to 3,000 children are born with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder each year in this country alone. This government has taken vital action to reduce that harm.
Question number 11, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Regional Economic Development. What is the total value of projects announced as part of the Provincial Growth Fund, and what is the best estimate of the number of jobs those projects will create?
The Honourable Shane Jones.
Mr. Speaker, I'm advised that the PGF has approved 796 projects and contracts are in place for 658 of them. About 2.7 billion has been committed and roughly 2.4 billion announced. On the question of the number of jobs, my frustration has been well documented. The Provincial Growth Fund over the COVID period and after the COVID period are undertaking a stock take of job numbers. Early in the life of the Provincial Growth Fund, a statement of 10,000 as an estimate over the life of the fund was identified. I look forward to being able to provide that information once additional verification has been undertaken.
Given that the very purpose of the Provincial Growth Fund is to, quote, create sustainable jobs, end quote, does he not think it would be more appropriate to actually know how many jobs are created before those projects are committed to?
Sir, as I have said, the number of jobs will be declared at a point in time where the weather is propitious. In addition to that, I would tell the member over 11,000 people have been enrolled in skills and training initiatives, and obviously there are many vagaries with the ebb and flow of provincial economies, but if the member just waits at a point where a propitious wind strikes, he will have the information.
Does he believe a cost of nearly $300,000 per job created represents a good investment by the taxpayer?
As I said, the member is plucking figures without full information. And that may be his stock and trade, but I would say, Mr. Speaker, to the House, just await the verification process, and at an auspicious period of time over the next few weeks, a suitable announcement will flow.
Has there been any improvement on the level of actual payments made since October 2019, when for every dollar committed then, just 12.9 cents had actually been paid out?
Mr. Speaker, as I said, the COVID episode enabled the Provincial Growth Fund to drill deeper into the treacle-riddled process. Sadly, that has unfortunately slowed down the flow of the cash, and on this I have complained publicly on numerous occasions, but on one hand, we have the Auditor-General's Office looking at the stewardship of the fund. On the other hand, we have Members of Parliament demanding that the money go out. A sensible and healthy balance has to be struck.
Before I go on, I just want to comment to the member around the tone of one of his answers where he suggested a member was plucking figures from the wind. Actually, all the member did was quote the member's own figures back to him, and therefore should not be greeted with such a pejorative comment. Figures that the member gave in his primary answer. The Honourable David Bennett.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Agriculture. What proportion of the $44 billion increase in primary sector export earnings over the next 10 years detailed in the government's Fit for a Better World roadmap would be generated from the dairy sector? Mr. Speaker, over the next 10 years, the dairy sector is expected to generate $4 billion of the total $44 billion targeted by the government's Fit for a Better World. Mr. Speaker, the $44 billion target is a target, indeed, not a limit. Supplementary. Will the Fit for a Better World economic roadmap's requirement of a 24 to 47% reduction in biogenic methane emissions over the next 10 years have a negative impact on the proportion of export earnings the dairy industry could provide?
Mr. Speaker, no, not necessarily at all, Mr. Speaker. We project there are huge opportunities to grow the value. As I say, the $44 billion is a target, not a limit, and I believe that we'll actually surpass that quite easily. I think the value we'll get in the marketplace from being committed to reduce our emissions from agriculture will give us the kind of lift that we see through market research at the moment, Mr. Speaker, where we see huge premiums for products that are firstly organic and then secondly that have been labelled at this point a regenerative. It's a term that New Zealand has yet to define. But that is connecting with a commitment to better animal welfare, to reduced emissions, to better systems of production that consumers are prepared to pay for.
If it is no, then how can the Minister say the effect will be no when Dairy NZ estimates that the 24 to 47% reduction in emissions will have a cost to the dairy industry of between $5 to $12 billion?
Mr. Speaker, I respect the work that Dairy NZ do, and they have estimated that, Mr. Speaker. I refer back to, I guess, the 80s, when, in fact, we had 70 million sheep. We now have half that number, but we produce the same amount of sheep meat. The ability and the potential for New Zealand farmers and agribusiness to innovate and to achieve the targets and the ambitions is unlimited in my view, and this target that we're setting, or that the Climate Change Commission will set, will take on board all the realities of the effect on local communities, the effect on the industries, Mr. Speaker, to achieve all the ambitions that we have of a low emissions economy but a higher returning agribusiness sector.
How's the government supporting innovation in the dairy sector, whether that be to achieve climate change targets or otherwise, and across the broader food and fibre sector to achieve the forecasted $44 billion increase in export earnings as set out in the Food for a Better World roadmap?
Mr. Speaker, the three documents that we have produced, that is the plan, making up Fit for a Better World, Mr. Speaker, has a number of core advisory areas. And, Mr. Speaker, research and education for our purposes is one. Precious water, ensuring that, Mr. Speaker. And, of course, seeking market game changes. And we have now a Sustainable Food and Fibre Futures Fund that we've committed another $84 million to, Mr. Speaker, available to anyone in the agribusiness sector with an innovative idea to add value to the production from this country.
Speaker, when the Minister talked about organics and regenerative agriculture as leading to that increase in the dairy industry, what evidence has he used to quantify those amounts?
Mr. Speaker, those are just a couple of the opportunities through innovation, through better pasture species, Mr. Speaker, through better productivity rates. Mr. Speaker, there are a whole range of things that are happening. Last week, with my colleague, the Honourable Phil Twyford, we launched the AgriTechs strategy, Mr. Speaker. The opportunities there are huge, and, Mr. Speaker, I think that that member over there shouldn't discredit his own sector that he represents by lowering the ambitions. And I think we have incredible potential. And those two things I mentioned, Mr. Speaker, are just a couple of the opportunities available to us.
Kieran McAnulty.
What role will agricultural training play in meeting the government's goal of $44 billion increase in primary sector export earnings?
Mr. Speaker, as I mentioned briefly before, research and education are a core part of achieving the goals, Mr. Speaker. We have been faced with a sector that has not had the proper training facilities in place. Through the good work and the support of that member in particular, we have now got Taratahi back up and running. We have Telford back up and running, Mr. Speaker. We have some decent training opportunities now in the agribusiness sector. And I thank the members on this side of the House for that support.
That concludes oral questions.